This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun. Hello, and welcome to episode 33 of the Clockwork Game Design Podcast. I'm your host, Keith Burgun. So today's episode is going to be just a big combination of a bunch of different things. I've got a bunch of user questions recently. I don't know why I said user. I guess it's like my developer subconscious coming through. Reader and listener questions, I should say. And so I'm going to talk about some of those. I'm going to talk a bit about self-expression in games, formalism, the concept of flow, which I get asked about a lot, and a few other things. We'll get into those. So first, let me just say that you probably know about my company, Dino Farm Games, that made Oro, and before that, 100 Rogues. And we've just been in like a serious transition period where we're trying to figure out like what's a good business model for us and like where should we exist. And I went to this game design conference back in November, and it was really eye-opening for me in a lot of ways because, you know, most of the people there were like AAA game developers and that had, you know, 9-to-5 normal jobs. A lot of them were like very high up ranking people at like big companies. And so there was like them, there really weren't many like indie video game developers. And there was a few board game designers and some academic type people. But just from talking to a lot of people there, I really just got the impression like, man, maybe I really kind of think that Dino Farm Games and perhaps my own work also, I should have been in board games like kind of all along, not because of the medium. I've written before about the limitations actually of the board game, you know, the non-digital medium for games, and I stand by those claims. But in terms of like having a functional business, and you know, I'm not talking about like getting rich or being like super successful, but just having something that's sustainable, I really think that the basic models available in board games probably would have suited us better. Another way that that would have suited us better is to just be more of an indie, where like, you know, our games are just a lot smaller in scope. You kind of can't skimp on game design. Like if you want a game to be good, it's just going to take a long time. You know, between that and having like trying to have like a semi like really nice looking production and stuff, it's just, it gets really crazy. It, you know, and that's why one of the reasons that Oro took so long. The other big reason that Oro took so long is that, you know, Blake, Dino Farm Games is myself and Blake Reynolds, who is a visual artist. We both met in studio, composition school and, you know, music composition, actually. And so we can both do that. He's a very good visual artist. I'm a okay visual artist, sort of, and I'm a game designer, and I can program a little bit between the two of us, our programming resources are actually quite low. They've gotten better in the last couple of years, but for the, you know, historically, it has been a major problem for us, and it's not one of our strengths. And so that's another reason that we're thinking about going into board games. Anyway, I wrote this big article over at dinofarmgames.com, and so I do recommend checking that out. I think anyone interested in the business of indie game development and publishing probably should read that article and see what we are up to. My experience here doing the Patreon for my articles and these podcasts, I would say has been pretty positive. Like, and has kind of worked for me. You know, I mean, I don't make a ton from my Patreon. I think at its best, it was a little over $100 a month. But I mean, that's kind of like makes it, you know, that helps a little bit. I mean, that helps pay for, you know, server like hosting and things like that, so that at least I'm not like losing money on doing these kind of things. I mean, I guess if you put in all the time that I put towards article writing and all that kind of stuff, like I don't have ads or anything like that, so it's definitely a huge net loss still, but like with every subscriber that I get, or you know, Patreon patron that I get, it's less and less of a loss. And so that's kind of a nice thing, and it sort of works out pretty well. And I think that a game development studio, at least my hope is that for a game development studio like Dino Farm that really wants to make these like premium games that are just unique and really strong, like evergreen games that don't do a lot of the stuff that, you know, a lot of other games do in terms of kind of sketchy free to play addiction marketing weird stuff with, like, you know, just in-app purchases and all that kind of stuff. Like, if you know, if you just want a nice, like, deep, interesting video game or board game, I think that Dino Farm, that's the kind of stuff we want to make without, like, having the marketing and the monetization scheme, like, be something that's, like, dragging down the system itself. So that's our big thing. That's something that's been going on. And so that's been shaking stuff up a lot because we had another project with Dino Farm that we were working on for a while. I don't know exactly what's going to happen with that project yet, but it's definitely shifting gears. Okay, so that's a little bit of, you know, housekeeping out of the way. I still have my own game that I'm working on, and I'll be talking about that more soon. I think I say that all the time. So we'll probably talk, I'll have an article about that or something pretty soon. So stay tuned. Okay, so first topic, formalism. I remember maybe 3 or 4 years ago was the first time that I really heard, and I've heard people say, talk about formalism, but people started calling me a formalist. And I self-identified that way as a formalist. So a very simple explanation of what formalism is. Formalism is the study of art by analyzing and comparing form and style, the way objects are made and their purely visual aspects. So that's for visual art. But for music, it would be just the notes on the page. For games, it would just be the rules or perhaps maybe the art and you know, but the things that are inside the thing, as opposed to a wider view of art that's sort of like takes a contextual analysis. Here's a theory of art on Wikipedia that says the formalist theory of art asserts that we should focus only on the formal properties of art, the form, not the content. Those formal properties might include, for the visual arts, color, shape, and line, and for the musical arts, rhythm and harmony. Right. It asserts that we should focus only on the formal properties. Now, there's very few people who actually believe this, I think. Like, it would only be the most abstract, like, arty people who actually would qualify for a technical definition of formalism. Almost anyone working in the arts, in media, does not qualify by this standard. Because everyone cares to some extent what their content is, you know, and understands, you know, they're not going to have like racial slurs in their game, probably, unless there's some, you know, contextual reason to do that. And probably even not then, because it's probably just not even, it's like probably a bad idea, no matter, even if you have some like high concept reason to use such a thing. I think that the idea, I kind of just think that formalism, like strict formalism, is almost like it seems like one of those things that only gets called on someone else. Like, I forget the name of it, but there's this word. It's like a word like homonym or something like that. It's not that, but it's a word that means the type of descriptor that only gets applied to other people. Like, no one self-applies it. There's a word for that. If someone can remember what that word is, I don't know how to look that up. Anyway, the point is, I do think that formalist in our game development and in game design circles really only gets used as a pejorative term to sort of, you know, to kind of try to cut down people who are, like myself, who are trying to actually come up with, you know, technical, tactical ways to create better machines, better things. So I'm not a formalist by the technical definition, and I'm also not a formalist. I'm like nothing like a formalist. I would say that the only way that I even, like, relatively speaking, look like a formalist compared to other designers is that I care more about, you know, craft, and I actually want to advance our craft. That doesn't mean at all that I don't care about content. And, you know, I will say this too, that in the last few years, my caring about content, I've always cared about content, but I care more about content and contextual meaning and what am I actually contributing to the culture and how am I going to be influencing people in a moral or political way? That's stuff that I think about more now, but I never didn't think about it. I certainly never had a philosophical view that one shouldn't care about it. But I think it's like this straw man that gets slung at people who, like myself, who do want the craft to advance. I want both things to advance. I want the content to advance. I want our culture to get better morally and more aware and more, acknowledging of context. And at the same time, I want our craft to improve. And I do think that craft does improve over time. That's a view that's it's not totally non-controversial. It's a little bit controversial, I should say. But yeah, I get called a formalist because I call for improving the formal aspects of games. And now, another thing I will say is I tend to talk more about formal properties of games. This is another reason that maybe perhaps if I'm being as charitable as possible, someone could be making this an honest mistake. I do talk most of the time about formal properties of games. But that's not because I think it's more important. It's because two things. One, I think that there's not a lot of people working on that problem. I think that there's it's kind of a neglected problem. I kind of generally have the feeling that for the most part, that people tend to think that interactivity and, interactive merit and the skill of designing interactive systems is basically solved. We basically know, you have three or four different things you can do with interactive systems in terms of the interactivity. And it's really just all about what's the setting and who are the characters and, what kind of cultural message are you sending? So I tend to think that actually, and I guess this could sound like I'm making the exact opposite criticism, and perhaps it sounds a bit strawman-ish, but I do think it is my true perspective, my true point of view, that a lot of other designers, and again, it could just be because I'm so focused on formal improvement. And so from my vantage point, all I ever hear is people sort of fighting back against that. And so it might seem more there's less formal improvement out there than there is. But that's my point of view. My point of view is that it's people don't really talk about that very much. I think there's a little bit of evidence to back that up. I mean, I've just recently done a bit of a research project looking into who's writing about game design. I also run the game design subreddit. And I can tell you that the kinds of stuff that I do with talking about something like the information horizon and, the interactive forms and making pronouncements about what is ideal game design and that kind of stuff, there's not a lot of people doing that. I mean, if I strained and sat here and did some research, I could probably find five people on the internet that do that kind of thing. Historically speaking, if I pick people who used to do that, I probably could get the number up to 20 or so, definitely no more than 30. Oh, and it's funny, you actually will find more of that in people from people outside of games, people who are not game developers, but people who are psychologists or AI researchers or, game theorists. You'll find more formal interactive merit research being done, by people outside of our field than inside our field. So I feel like I'm decently in touch with what the conversation is. And I don't know. I mean, I'd love to hear some pushback on this, but it seems to me that very little effort's being applied to this problem. So that's one thing, is that I feel that this problem is not being addressed. The other thing is I just happen to feel that I've I actually have something to contribute here. Like, I feel like I'm onto something. I feel like I've been onto something with Interactive Merit for the last few years. And, you know, that's something that I wrote about in my books and in the 3 Minute Game Design podcast and in this podcast. And over time, it's not so far the kind of thing where, you know, oh, I thought I had this theory for game design, and then it turned out, oh, it doesn't really work. Like, it's, you know, it's changing over time. But for the most part, I would say it's actually getting, like, stronger and more, it's getting more flexible in some ways, but in some other ways, it's getting less flexible and more, solid and just more detail. It's being more and more fleshed out over time. You know, early on, I talked about randomness in terms of input and output randomness. And I think that is useful to a point, but later I came up with the idea of the information horizon and how randomness exists on the spectrum. And then I've been more recently talking about, you know, the difference between calculation and like analysis and figuring out like, you know, what's the relationship there? Like how much of that is good? How much is not good? So I feel I make progress. I feel that I am contributing something. And so those are the reasons why I talk about formal interactive merit topics so much and why I don't talk about, you know, content issues as much. However, I will say I do talk about content issues quite a bit. One of the things that, you know, I talk about all the time is violence in games. And I think that's how much I talk about like violence and the portrayals of people in games and, I think that should totally exclude me from being a formalist. I mean, if I write one article about like violence glorification in games, I am not a formalist, seems to me. And I've written like 7. So, I don't know. To be fair, I haven't heard people call me a formalist that much recently, but I just haven't, the types of people who would call me a formalist just haven't really been interacting with me that much. So, anyway, I wanted to talk about the whole formalism thing. And I don't know, do you guys know any formalists? Anyone who would self-identify that way or that you would identify that way? To me, it seems like a mostly useless term, except in, you know, you can, like, I could see that one person's more formalist than another person, but no one is a formalist. So that's my point of view on that. Okay, topic number 2. Let's go into a user question. This first question is from Robin Aris. They say, "Hi, Keith. I'm not sure if you touched on this subject before, as I'm currently only 75% through the Clockwork Game Design podcast, but I was wondering what you think about so-called, quote, grand strategy games. And then mainly the Paradox stuff like Crusader Kings, Europa Universalis, Hearts of Iron, etc. I'm sorry if you already discussed this in one of the last podcast episodes. I haven't had a chance to listen to them yet. If not, maybe this is something you could discuss in an upcoming episode." He actually has like a second follow-up question. So I'm gonna answer the first question first. I think that those things, the grand strategy games, are among the best way you can spend your time with video games these days. I do classify them as toys, and I think that they are pretty good toys. You know, they don't really have goals. You can sort of, like, some of them have, like, scenarios that have goals, and, like, they do have, like, these loose goals, and they have, like, a score. But, you know, they're really toys. They're really just, like, big fantasy strategy toys is maybe a good way to put it. So generally I like them. The one I played the most of was Crusader Kings 2, I think. And to be honest, they're so complicated that like it's they're not easy to get into. They definitely get like a F on accessibility. But you know, like I said, they're some of the best toys out there, and there's some really cool things that happen in them. It's kind of like playing like Dwarf Fortress or Roguelike, honestly. You just have this big like machine, and you sort of play with it and see what happens. And I don't play them much, but I appreciate them. And if I were to play, you know, if I were the kind of person who played 3, 4, or 5 hours of video games a day, I would probably fit them in. I guess I don't have any other real significant comments on them because, you know, they're toys. I think probably the way to make them better is, you know, it'd be great if people could make them a little easier to learn to play. But, you know, I think honestly beyond that, though, the more complicated, the better for toys, for things like that. The more just stuff, almost the better. Yeah, I mean, that's my opinion on it. Toys are, you know, they're not that hard to design. I think that they are, you know, there's the interactive forms and they're at the bottom and they're the least like fine form. They're very coarse and very, they're easy to make and they sort of always work, but they have a very kind of limited, you know, one of the crappy things about toys, and these things definitely qualify here, is that, you know, there's a lot of downtime. They're very inefficient with people's players' time. There's a lot of time where you're just going to be going through motions and just kind of like just doing the stuff that you got to do, and nothing surprising happens. And or if something does surprising, is technically surprising, it's just the results of some random event and it's not actually surprising. I recommend them. They're better than most video games for sure. Oh, the second question is, also, in one of the last episodes I listened to, you were talking about a new YouTube series you wanted to make. Has anything ever come from that? No, not yet. Well, technically, I have like almost a whole episode ready to go for a video series that I want to do, which, by the way, is another like super not formalist type of thing to do. It's about like media analysis and stuff. I have a whole episode ready to go, and I want to do that series, but you know, things are coming up, things are going on. And the other thing is, I don't know, like, I want to kind of unify things a little bit. I have so many things going on and it's sort of a little bit scattered. So I, you know, what I want to do is like find a way to brand this video series in some kind of way that, I don't know, like, underneath my own game design stuff or something. So anyway, I got to think about the branding element of it and sort of fitting it into a larger kind of package. So, but once I do that, I mean, I'll have an episode ready to go pretty soon, and I'm pretty excited about it too. It's just that there's so much else going on. Okay, next topic. So I've talked before about the Dino Farm forums, and I really recommend that people come by if they're looking for a good community for discussing game design. Warning that there is a politics section of the forum that is very dark and very lots of you know, it's a video games like this is a forum that came out of video games, so the how do I put this in a nice way, the typical political opinions of a serious video game player are reflected in the politics section of the forum. So, you know, racism isn't real, sexism isn't real, what else? All kinds of dreadful things. So just a heads up there. There's a few people that don't think that way, but in general, it's a little bit of a landmine in that section, but we've sort of cordoned off that section to be its own little section recently. But the game design stuff is great. The games, like, we talk about other games that are coming out and like kind of give little mini reviews of stuff, and it's really good and it's really useful. So I do recommend it. I think it's one of the best sites for talking about game design on the internet. There's a lot of good people that are very smart. Interestingly, even there's a lot of people that, you know, politically just are on the opposite end of the planet from me. And then when we go into talk about game design, it's like pretty productive. And, you know, we don't all agree, but like it's, you know, there's a conversation. So anyway, I got a conversation. Here's an example question and answer on the Dino Farm forums. Don Derper asked, how do you feel about the observation that your particular set of design rules appear to be geared towards maximizing flow? Now, flow is one of those concepts it's actually a concept in psychology, and it's not designed for games. but is something that definitely applies to games. And a lot of game design people who like even dabble the slightest bit in formalist interactive merit kind of talk will almost always, one of the only things they'll talk about is flow. You know, it's kind of, honestly, it's sort of sad how much flow comes up as like a game design lesson kind of thing, for a couple of reasons. One, it's actually not that applicable, which I'll talk about in a second. And the other thing is that it like reveals this sort of verificationist kind of attitude of our, of people in games when it comes to formal improvement of the discipline of, you know, designing interactive systems. It's like, we can't talk about anything unless it's been like proven in like, you know, like it's just totally agreed upon in the scientific community, which, you know, I don't know that flow necessarily is, but it's enough so that video game developers can actually talk about it. And so you just hear it over and over and over again. Anyway, I wanted to read my response to that question. How do I feel about the observation that my set of design rules appear to be geared towards maximizing flow? The answer I wrote was, I generally think flow tends to be a byproduct of a good Clockwork game, but it's really not the goal or the intention. A really good gambling machine will induce flow. I generally dislike the term because it's something that applies to really any interactive system or object. You know, so to take an aside for a second, you know, a good car sort of induces flow. Anything that you use for like in a repetitive sort of way over time will induce flow to some extent, or at least facilitate flow. I said, also, a few of those bullet points seem just straight up undesirable for a strategy game. He had linked me to the Wikipedia page on flow. And some of those points. So point one, intense and focused concentration on the present moment. Well, I wrote about this in my most recent article, or second to most recent article. No, it was my last podcast episode. I'm sorry. how actually we don't really want people to be intense and focused concentration. I mean, I guess it depends on how that's defined, but you know, it doesn't have to be intense. Game playing can be sort of relaxed. So one is like, sort of, I guess they mean that they don't want you to be being distracted. They do want you to be like, you know, your attention is on this game. And so that's like, maybe that's like a half point. So number two component of flow is, according to this Wikipedia page on flow, the second component is merging of action and awareness. That I would mostly agree with, I guess. Three, a loss of reflective self-consciousness. Now that is totally not at all required for a good strategy game. If that happens, it's fine, but it's not at all something that we're shooting for. Like, I mean, that's something that you're shooting for in like a fantasy simulator or something, maybe a gambling machine, because you want people to like forget and just be like so hooked that they just are kind of in a trance. But there's no reason you would actively want players to do that in a strategy game. Again, it's not necessarily a problem if they do, but you're not gunning for that. Four, a sense of personal control or agency over the situation or activity. Yes, I don't know that you need a sense of personal control or agency. As long as you intellectually know that you have personal control or agency over the activity, I think it's fine, but sort of a half point, I guess. Five, a distortion of temporal experience. One's subjective experience of time is altered. Now this one, like, I don't want that in my strategy games at all. I mean, I would love to make a phenomenal strategy game that the player does not lose track of time playing it at all. They love playing it. It's super fun. And they have complete awareness over how much time they're spending playing it. That would be my ideal. I do not want players to be like, oh shit, I didn't realize 2 hours went by. Like, that has no value. Now, it may be that when a player really gets involved in a strategy game, that may happen. And, you know, maybe it's worth that, but that's certainly not a goal. And then six, experience of the activity as intrinsically rewarding, also referred to as autotelic experience. Yeah, so intrinsically rewarding, I do agree with that one. Anyway, hopefully my going through this list quickly shows that flow is not at all like a goal for me as a game designer, and I really don't think it's a goal for most game designers. Maybe for, you know, people making interactive experiences like VR and stuff like that, that's probably more applicable to them. But someone making a strategy game, flow is totally irrelevant as far as I'm concerned. You could have all these things or not. And in either case, you could have a great strategy game or a terrible strategy game. So to answer that question fully, the answer is no. Flow has nothing to do with my work, pretty much. I'll just finish reading my response on the Dino Farm forums. Oh yeah, I just said the same thing. I don't see any reason why you'd want players to lose track of time while playing. I mean, if it happens because the game is that engrossing, okay, but I'd rather the game was 100% engrossing and the player continued to be able to track time. Right. One more thing about flow. People probably, are thinking about flow because with regards to my work, probably because of my 50% win rate findings. And because there's this classic chart that you see everywhere in game design articles and things of that nature that just has like too hard, too easy, right in the middle, and you have this flow channel. And you know, I think I don't think that's like BS. I think that is kind of true. It's just that my reasoning for coming to my 50% win rate as the ideal win rate for games has nothing to do with the reason that, like, it's incidental that flow also suggests, the whole flow theory thing also suggests that. It's for different reasons. So there's, you know, it's sort of an overlap, but it's kind of incidental. It's not for the same reasons. Or if it is for the same reasons, it's like very indirectly so. So I'm not trying to, you know, like get this flow channel thing between boredom and anxiety or whatever it is. That's not the objective. The objective is measuring something clearly, as I've talked about many times before. But anyway, just wanted to make that distinction. So I got this other question, and I apologize, but I forgot to write down who gave me this question, and I don't know where I got it from, whether it was an email or a comment somewhere. But another question from a listener said, "Hey, you mentioned it briefly in this episode and previously too, but interested if you had any insight into why there seems to be this gap between accessible and deep games and other art. It's something that I wrestle with the concept of daily, both in designing and in my own life. If others are interested, maybe you could touch on it in a future episode." Well, I'm touching on it now. I actually wrote down a little thing, so I'm going to read that thing and then I'll riff on it a bit. It's an important topic, but I don't know that there's a whole ton to talk about with the whole depth/accessibility thing. Basically, it comes down to deep things contain more information. More information takes longer to learn than less information. And that's the crux of the problem. Design is basically the process of finding more productive ways to convey more information in a smaller amount of time. You can use symbols as shortcuts and order the information in ways that deliver the information faster. But design in that way is kind of a hack. So that's what I wrote so far. To reiterate that a little bit. There is a, inverse relationship between depth and accessibility, typically, with design being the thing that allows us to kind of achieve both to some varying degrees. But yes, the more complicated something is, whether this is in art, whether it's in film, whether it's in anything, the more information there is to learn, and the more information there is to learn, the harder it is for the person to perceive it in a way that makes sense to them. And on the other hand, the simpler something is, the more accessible it's going to be because there's less to learn. Now, in storytelling and in music and we've figured out ways to intelligently introduce the information so that we can introduce more information without like losing the user to use that word again. And in games, we're just sort of like just starting to think about that. But either way, that's what I mean by it being kind of a hack. Like it's using craft to get both depth and accessibility. Although it's always like an uphill fight, you know, it's always going to be, you know, you take two steps forward and one step back, or maybe even, yeah, something like that. It's always going to be like a difficult thing because, you know, and strategy games have to be extremely complex to actually work and not just be like an illusion like most strategy games currently are. So, yeah, they have to be very complicated because human beings are very, very smart. And so it makes it very hard for them to be accessible. And I think that some of my work, you know, in terms of like the core mechanism and supporting mechanisms, that whole thing, that is there to be work as a framework for how we can start asking this question. But yeah, hopefully that answers the question about depth and accessibility. All right, so yeah, I had a couple other things that I was gonna talk about, but I think they're a little bit half baked, so I'm gonna move on and I'm gonna wrap this one up early. I've been thinking about doing, well, so yeah, there's gonna be a ton of really cool stuff going on. Look forward to that Dino Farm Patreon. Please do read that Dino Farm Games article that I wrote. I think that game developers will find that really interesting. Also, I recommend you come by the Reddit, the game design subreddit. If you're a reader of this, or a listener rather, of this podcast, I really think that you would have a lot to contribute to the game design subreddit. So, and I was also just saying this recently, like, we need more people. This goes back to like what I was saying about formalism and a few other things in this podcast episode, but we need more people to like write about game design. So if you're thinking about starting a game design blog and you listen to this show and, you know, you have like similar views about advancing the medium of game design and especially specifically strategy game design, but game design generally, I really encourage you to start a blog or start a podcast of your own. And you know, let me know and I will tweet about you and stuff. I don't have that many followers and stuff, but you know, I would love to help people who are starting out and kind of cross promote with new people and just kind of get the conversation going a little more because I've just noticed because recently things have taken off a lot more on the Dino Farm forums and it's so nice to have some people to like bounce back off of you in a productive way. You know, so it's almost like when you don't have that, you're sort of just fighting on your own, which I've been doing, I feel like, on and off large stretches of time for years. And so yeah, it's good. And I really recommend that we need more people. Like I wrote about recently, like, or I think it was in a podcast episode that the discipline of writing about games and game design just collapsed since like 2012. So, you know, we need a new generation of game design writers. So if you're considering doing something like this, please consider doing it a little more. And, you know, I encourage you to do that. So, and let me know if you do have a blog that you're starting or whatever, post it on the Dino Farm forums, post it on the subreddit, game design subreddit. You can post it in the comments of this podcast if you want. Yeah. Oh, before I go, I did have one other person mention that they were interested to know what podcasts I listen to. And I am actually obsessed with podcasts. I listen to about, I would say, reasonably 3 to 4 hours of podcasts a day. And I listen to them all at 10% increased speed, you know, 1.1x speed, which is, I think, the perfect speed to listen to podcasts at because it doesn't make the speech sound strange at all, but it saves you, you know, well, I guess 10% of the time. So that's cool. I really love, so most of the podcasts I listen to, so if you're not interested in my podcasts, you can shut this off now and move on to the next thing. But for those who are interested in hearing about what podcasts I listen to, I may have done this before on the show, but it changes all the time. So I will now tell you about my favorite podcasts. Most of them are political, just so you know, and most of them share my political views. Not all of them, though. I have such a huge list of podcasts. So the one that's going to get a special mention right up front is going to be the Ezra Klein Show, which is an interview show run by Vox's Ezra Klein. And it's just him talking. There's like almost no editing, just him talking to a guest, kind of like the Charlie Rose or whatever. And he just had a big interview, an hour and 40 minute interview with Ta-Nehisi Coates on his show. And I really found it fantastic. I really recommend that podcast and that episode in specific. My favorite podcast that I listen to every day, daily, is The Majority Report. I do think that Sam Seder is probably the best political analyst that exists right now. And I think that his co-host, Michael Brooks, can sometimes be a little bit immature and maybe has some other slight problems sometimes, but he's extremely funny and he's an amazing impressionist and he knows his shit about international policy. He's like extremely well versed in that stuff. So I do recommend The Majority Report. I also have been really enjoying On the Media from NPR, and I usually can't listen to NPR podcasts because they're overproduced, and everyone like is pretending to be emotional, and they like play this music, and there's like all these like dramatic drops, and the worst is like Radiolab. I wish I could listen to Radiolab because I love the content, but the production is so annoying, and the way that those hosts pretend that they don't know stuff that they definitely know, can't handle it. Okay, another recommendation. Slate's Amicus with Dahlia Lithwick is a good one about the Supreme Court, and that one does not have really a liberal or conservative bias. Maybe a little bit of a liberal bias, but not really. I mean, it's just a good show about the Supreme Court. I also really like Fareed Zakaria, his show GPS. It's actually a TV show on CNN, but I listen to the audio podcast version. A lot of the CNN shows are available in a audio podcast form, and I listen to a lot of them actually. But Fareed Zakaria's is my favorite, and his takes up at the beginning of the show, it's just like a little speech that he writes, are actually almost always great. Oh, and I'll mention one more, because it's a new one for me, and I'm not sure how I feel about it overall, but I thought I'd mention it. I listened to The Axe Files with David Axelrod, who I believe was Obama's campaign manager in 2008, and I listened to this one episode, episode 103, which was with Harry Reid, who is going to be leaving the Senate soon. And he just sort of told his like life story, and it's way more interesting than I thought. I had no idea this guy lived through this kind of stuff. Like it's mind blowing the kind of stuff that he went through. He's way more interesting than he sounds. And I don't know. It's one of those things that I find a lot of these like senator people when on their way out, I learn about like that they were kind of cool. So it makes me want to learn more about people who are in office now and try to appreciate who they are and what they do and what their life has been like. Anyway, that's another one of those like super unedited, just a big conversation. I'm a big fan of that. It's kind of a little low on the efficiency spectrum, but it's, you end up getting these little bits of information that you would never get in a more produced and more presented, you know, like cleanly presented show, I feel like. So anyway, that's my list of podcasts. I hope that wasn't like a horribly boring thing for people. Ask me. I like the format of this episode of like answering people's questions and talking about a bunch of different topics. If you liked it too, let me know. If you didn't like it, I can stick to the one big topic or the two sort of big topics. you know, trying different things out. I'd also love, if you have questions that you'd like me to talk about on the show, just, you know, leave them in a comment or email me. Thanks so much for listening, and I will see you next time.
This podcast is made possible by the patrons at patreon.com. To support the show, visit patreon.com/KeithBurgun.